You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Recognize that music? It's from a science fiction film. Here, it's a hard one to remember. You have to be pretty old to remember that one. Let me give you something that might be a little bit easier.
Gordon, Latu, Narada, Nikto, Latu, Narada, Nikto.
If you don't know Klaatu Arata Nikto, you're not a science fiction fan. That was from The Day the Earth Stood Still, the first one, the really good one. Most science movie fans would recognize that alien language, I think. And the first one, as I say, was a little tougher. It's a theme music from Metropolis, and that was a 1927 science fiction film that showed the technology. And it showed technology that was way ahead of its time in that movie. And this is our way of kicking off this hour's theme, science in films. And we're going to look at some of the old ones, like the two clips you've just heard, and three new films that you might want to catch this summer for your dose of science. So our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALKING. You can tweet us at SciFry, that's at SCIFRI, talking about science in the films. And joining me now to talk about science movies is my first guest, Sidney Perkowitz. He's the author of Hollywood Science, and he's also a professor of physics at Emory University. He joins us from a studio on the campus. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Perkowitz.
My pleasure, Ira. And if you call me Sidney, that makes me happy.
Okay. Can I call you Sid?
That's even better.
That's even better. Okay, Sidney. When was the first science fiction movie? Do you have a year on that, when the first one would have been?
Metropolis is pretty old, but there are even some older ones. There was an earlier Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which kind of comes under that heading, which preceded Metropolis by several years. So turn of the century is about when it was happening, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there that Trip to the Moon, a very older movie?
And that was even older, in the 1890s.
Wow.
By a French filmmaker. So, yes, it's an incredibly old genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to bring in another clip. We talked about those other two clips. Those are two of my favorite movies. But here, I saw a movie just this week that is a blockbuster, and it has to do with sort of modern science. And I want to bring a clip in from that film that we're going to be talking about. And let's go to hear that clip now.
It's a way of studying the origins of the universe, to try to isolate what some people call the God particle. But there are implications for energy research.
God particle?
What we call it isn't important. It's what gives all matter mass, the thing without which we could not exist.
You're talking about the moment of creation.
Yes, in a way I am.
There's that clip from Angels and Demons, Tom Hanks talking with the scientist there about the God particle. That's a summer blockbuster about the destructive possibilities of a substance called antimatter. And basically the plot in this is a fictional thief steals antimatter from the Real Hadron Collider at CERN. That's in Switzerland. And the characters race to stop a citywide explosion. With me now is Michael Tutz. He is the U.S. Atlas Operations Program Manager at CERN and Professor of Physics at Columbia University. Welcome to Science Friday. Did they get the science about the antimatter right in the film?
They got it mostly right. That is to say, if you look at the pieces, there is a CERN, there is a laboratory like that, there is a large hadron collider, an accelerator, and in that accelerator, in the experiments, we will make antimatter.
Can you put it in a bottle like they did?
No, we don't have that bottle to put it in. And the other thing is that it would take a very long time to accumulate as much as they actually had there.
They did say they had a breakthrough in making that much antimatter. You'd need some breakthrough.
You would, and we haven't seen that breakthrough.
So you're not going to transport it around the world like they do in a bottle?
No. Again, in principle, you could imagine some kind of bottle to capture the antimatter, but you wouldn't be able to imagine it in that little small container that they had.
She also talked about the God particle. What was she talking about?
So the God particle really refers to what's known as the Higgs particle. And it's the Higgs particle that, as they alluded to in the movie, that gives all the elementary particles their mass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's responsible for the mass of all the elementary particles. And so, indeed, it's something that we are looking for and that the experiments at the LHC will look for.
Sidney Perkowitz, putting real science like that in a movie seems to be more of a trend these days, getting some real good science in some of these movies.
And in fact, some directors feel that audiences are really sophisticated about science and they want at least a little dose of it and fairly well done, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I'd say it is a trend.
Yeah, and the fact that that they used real pictures from the Large Hadron Collider, Michael, that was the real thing, right?
That was the real thing, and so for me, the first 5 minutes of the movie were the best. That was
the last 5 minutes. I'm not going to give away the end, but the last 5 minutes has the scientist, the female scientist, and sort of questioning whether she should be a scientist anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you find that to be realistic?
No. I haven't had those doubts.
Uh-huh.
The other thing that isn't realistic is that they showed all these particle physicists wearing white lab coats.
I'm so glad you mentioned that.
I've never seen a particle physicist wear a white lab coat.
Never. I've worked at some big installations too, and it's something you never ever see.
But Sidney, that's how things have changed in the films from the pre-World War II, that era where we had the mad scientist in his white lab coat. We're not seeing that at all, and we're seeing these young guys with the old mad scientists of these old wiry-haired things.
And, yeah, they still have the white lab coats, but they're generally better looking, and some of them are even sexy. So that's a big change.
I guess who would be the first sexy Jeff Goldblum, maybe?
Jeff Goldblum, right. He was pretty aggressive and even attractive in the Jurassic Park series.
And in The Fly.
Well, before The Fly hit. After that, he was not such a good-looking guy.
He even played James Watson in an old flick about.
That's right.
And James Watson didn't think he was sexy enough for him when they asked him about whether he was a sexy enough scientist.
So we'll have to all start worrying about who's going to play us, right?
Well, we're going to talk about a movie, a documentary later called Blast, where there were real scientists in this, and none of them are wearing any kind of lab coats. They're mostly graduate students and college students in there.
That's right.
Yeah. So what did you think of the movie? You said after the first 5 minutes, it lost a lot of its science.
It did. I thought it was a good adventure movie, so I don't know. I give it a B or something like that.
Sid, would you give it a pretty good rating for science in the film?
The science wasn't too bad. It confused some things, I think, like antimatter and the God particle and so on, but these are mere details. Just having CERN mentioned, and another thought that crossed my mind, Ira, was when they showed the idea of particles going down all the piping in CERN, how beautiful it would be if we could actually have a teaching film that used all that technology to give a great visual representation.
That's a great idea.
That would be a great medium for teaching. Yeah.
Yeah, it really personalized and popularized that whole place, didn't it? And the whole idea of looking for of doing physics, that these were real people doing the physics there, and it was kind of exciting.
You can do physics and see all of Rome and solve a mystery. It's quite a combination.
Exactly right.
All in 2 hours and 14 minutes.
Yeah, it's only going to take us 20 years of running to do it.
Well, but the good news is that people now learn more, probably from this movie, wouldn't you think? More people will know about CERN and that collider than any other thing.
Absolutely. I think it's tremendous, right? Because it raises the excitement. Kids look about it and think, wow, is that thing really exist? Or is this laboratory there? And then the answer is, yeah, it's there.
And when they hear it up and running sometime later this year, it's going to get up and running?
We hope that by the end of the year. It had an accident when it started off in last September, but it's getting ready, and we hope that by the end of the year it'll be up and running. So we hope, again, that that excitement will be generated again.
Sid, when you talk to scientists, do they try to shy away from being the subject or to talk about science in movies?
Yes, there's an old tradition, which is partly true and partly not so true, that journalism and the media never represent science right. And a lot of scientists do get uptight about that. So you'll find a certain hardcore which will reject a whole movie if there's even one scientific mistake in it.
Mm-hmm.
But a younger scientist are more relaxed, and our attitude is you're allowed a little suspension of disbelief as long as you have a good movie and get a lot of the science right.
We talked about some of the old movies. Do you have a favorite old science movie of yours?
Oh, Metropolis, Head and Shoulders is just a winner, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. The two that you mentioned were great choices.
I like the original War of the Worlds. II myself.
That was also quite good, and in my opinion, better than the later War of the Worlds.
Ugh.
Yeah, good. It sounds like you agree.
Well, it wasn't just think about the first one, is that there was a real scientist was a hero. There was a scientist who was a hero of that movie, you know?
Yes. He used his knowledge to try to stop the Martians. I mean, how could a scientist be more heroic than that?
Yeah, and then they had to take that away from a scientist in the second one and just give it to someone who was not a scientist. So,
They made it a human story, which has its good points, but they sure drained all the science out of the second version.
Yeah, and in fact, you couldn't. I don't think you could understand what happened in that second. Why the Martians died in the end of that movie?
Right.
If you hadn't seen the first movie.
That's right.
If you hadn't seen that first movie, you would not have known why the Martians died. So maybe someone will come up with the third version. Because, look, they did the Day the Earth Stood Still, that second version was awful, right?
Agreed.
Right.
Agreed.
I mean, it was such a small film, the first film, such a beautiful first film, such a film with dialogue. And what? The second movie is all just action.
Yeah. I mean, exactly right. It's all action. Well, it's... typical day in the life of a physicist.
You agree, Sid?
Yes, I totally agree. That's what we do all day. After you get the PhD, you get CIA training, and then you're off and running.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. As I said, you're going to stay with us, but I want to thank you, Michael, for coming down from Columbia. And we'll wait to see them get this thing going, right?
Yeah,
later in the year.
I hope
do we have a time that's
well. It's going to be in the fall. There isn't an exact date yet because it's still a little complicated about getting the repairs done. But by the end of the year, I hope someone will be on your show talking about it.
Well, we hope so too. But thank you very much for taking time to come down to visit us, Michael Tutz is the U.S. Atlas Operations Program Manager at CERN and Professor of Physics at Columbia University. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk lots more about movies. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can Twitter us at SciFry. We're going to talk about the documentary film Blast about scientists, graduate students, sort of amateur engineers putting together a telescope that gets launched way up there in the atmosphere looking for the origins of the universe. And also come back and talk about a science fiction movie called Sleep Dealer. So stay with us. Lots to talk about. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to talk about science and the films this hour. Next up is a documentary film that chronicles the journey of a team of researchers trying to launch a high-powered telescope into the upper atmosphere. Not as a satellite, but this is using the old-fashioned method and the cheaper method, as we learn, a giant helium balloon. And the telescope's going to take some very old pictures of some very old light that's been trapped in the dust of stars since creation. And it's a very, very interesting story. And the film is called Blast, and it's named after the name of the telescope. And joining us to talk about this film is director Paul Devlin and his brother Mark, astrophysicist professor at Pennsylvania State University. And both Paul and Mark join us in our studios here today in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
Why did you make this movie? You have a lot of other documentary films.
Yeah, I've done quite a few documentaries. This is Paul, the filmmaker. And I got into the film basically at the invitation of my brother, the astrophysicist at University of Pennsylvania. And he was dropping me off at the train station one day, and he says, I'm going to Sweden to launch my telescope on a balloon in a few weeks. You want to join me? And I looked at him and I said, no, not really.
See you later.
But then I thought about it and I said, hey, well, you know, if you can get me a free flight and put me up, then all right, yeah, I'll come to Sweden and I'll spend a few days documenting the launch and getting it on tape, and we can, you know, see what happens with it. We'll put it on the website or use it in a talk or something like that. I expected to spend 4 or 5 days. I wound up spending 4 or 5 weeks because the project was delayed by technical problems and weather delays.
Right.
So while I was there waiting for the launch, I started getting into this story about what they were going through and the obstacles they had to overcome, the tensions that were happening, and I realized that, hey, there's a good story.
There's a real personal story.
Exactly.
Here.
So, and I had nothing to do but shoot, so I just put my camera in their face all the time and got some interesting characters and narratives that emerged. And so from there, once, you know, we don't want to spoil the end of the movie, but they had quite a few disasters that happened along the way
right.
that enlarged the picture.
Well, Mark, did you have trouble with your brother hanging out with you, watching you do all this stuff?
I like my brother, but you know, it's a bit much to have somebody putting a camera in your face all the time. And as he said, I'm the principal investigator of the experiment, and he felt like all my students had to let him talk to him. But I think eventually they warmed up to the whole idea of having somebody there. And as he says, you know, once somebody's there all the time, you get to get used to them.
This is actually a story where the fact is stranger than fiction. I mean, the what you went through, the trials and tribulations of the first failure, the first flight, and then the second, what happened on the second flight, you know, the personal experience that went on there. You could not have written a better script, could you?
As I gave a talk last night where after we showed the movie, and I said, well, you know, it could have worked the first time. It would have been great for me. It would have been horrible for the movie.
Right? Yeah, so they had quite a few disasters. They start in Arctic Sweden, and they have to launch the telescope on a balloon to the top of the atmosphere, and it just travels on the wind to Arctic Canada, and they drop it in polar bear country sort of randomly and have to go and find it. And in that process, you know, they had a lot of disasters that the telescope, you know, had some problems. So they had to do that all over again in Antarctica. And, and so that's where I realized I sort of had an epic story. And we followed it for 2.5 years.
And you passed the dental test.
Passed the dental test, passed all those tests.
I remember I went there 30 years ago, and I had the dental test was still the biggest part of the worry that you worried about.
You got to be healthy to go to Antarctica.
Yeah, actually, I had to have a tooth removed.
Is that right? it's a very unforgiving place, you learn. That. You can't make very many mistakes.
They say it's a harsh continent, yes.
And it's the driest place on Earth. How widespread can we see this movie? Where is it being shown?
Well, we just released it in New York City theatrically. And before that, we were at the Imagine Science Film Festival here in New York. Mm-hmm. And we got great reviews in Variety and New York Times. And so now we're taking it out across the country. We've got invitations from independent theaters in San Francisco and Virginia and Minneapolis. And we're approaching more. So we also want to take it out as an independent. We have to look for innovative ways to get the film out since we can't really compete in the multiplexes. So we're talking to museums and planetariums, universities and schools. And so we expect it to be get quite a bit of exposure over the next few weeks and months. Mm-hmm. Also, we have on our website, blastthemovie.com, we have a place where there's a map where people can have screening requests. And we're looking at getting people involved who may not have a venue close to them but still want to see the movie. And we're talking about organizing house parties and special events to screen it, because we really want to get this, in addition to getting it, the DVD, eventually to schools and even high schools, because we really want to get people excited about science, because we think the adventure element brings in the general audience. And in New York, we found that whole families were showing up to the film, and the kids were participating enthusiastically in the Q&As. So we didn't really realize that we had a kids' film until we started taking it out. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about bringing it out to the general public and having people come to us and have screenings all over the country.
Sid Perkowitz is also with us. He's author of Hollywood Science. He's professor of physics at Emory University. Sidney, you got any chance to see this film?
Yes, I did see it. I enjoyed it a lot. I want to say hello to Mark Devlin because I'm a Penn graduate, Mark. I got my PhD there.
How long ago?
So it's really – oh, I don't want to tell you that. We didn't overlap.
Okay.
It was great to see some scenes of the Penn campus in the film.
Yeah, those buildings are still there.
Rittenhouse Lab is still there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What this film showed is what the life of a scientist can be like. We don't all go to Antarctica, but mostly when you do an experiment, it doesn't work. It's harder when you're on a NASA timetable and you have something as delicate as launching a balloon, but the basic idea applies to every scientist. So scientists, I think, really appreciate this film. I also like the presence of all the grad students. And, Mark, it was great that one of your students was a woman. I think that's a great message to send. I would have loved to see a story in one of the grad students, what the failure of the experiment might have meant to one of them, because it has different implications than it has for the principal investigator. And that maybe could be a follow-up kind of story, too. But all in all, I think it was very well done, sends the kind of message we need to send out.
There could have been little films about everybody in this movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of threads. In fact, the Onion gave us one review and said there are 6 documentaries in here. You know, there was quite a few things that some real depth there.
There was also an interesting thread. We talked about it earlier in the hour about Angels and Demons, the science and religion thread in there. And there was a great large science and religion thread, Mark, in your film about one of the scientists trying to convince, was it you? Trying to convince you that there was a God behind finding something very important that they were looking for.
Yeah, that's true. Bart Netterfield, who's my comrade in arms in making the whole experiment work, is a devout Christian, and he believes. And mm-hmm. he prayed to make sure that they all would work out. And he was, when it looked like it wasn't going to happen, he was despaired. And then it all worked out in the end. And, you know, you mm-hmm. got to give him credit. I mean, it seemed like, from his point of view, it all had divine intervention.
But I would imagine a lot of scientists must not have liked that part of the movie.
There are my brother and I have coined a term, which is probably not new, called scientific fundamentalism, where we have a lot of scientists who see it are so offended by the idea that one of their own, so to speak, has these beliefs that they hate it. I mean, they hate it so much that they say the whole entire movie is about religion. And in fact, it's just a tiny thread in the movie.
It is a tiny, and to me, that's a strength of the film,
yeah.
I think.
And we get a lot of compliments for that. We get a lot of compliments for Paul had access to my family, and so he's in my house with his camera and my kids' faces. But they shows, you know what it's the personal aspect of doing this, and Bart mm-hmm. has his personal beliefs, and it would be a mistake not to show that.
When you were editing the film, did you think about cutting any parts out or leaving them in? Or
yeah, I mean, that's part of the process of editing, but I was definitely interested in drawing in a general audience, and so those elements are very accessible to a general audience. I mean, I have a lot of people who are not familiar with science find they can really relate to Bart's point of view, and they can relate to Mark's struggles with being separated from his family. So mm-hmm. so for me, that drawing in those people is very important. And mm-hmm. the interesting thing about Bart is that I don't think, he's managed to reconcile his scientific pursuit with his religious beliefs. And I don't think there's, you can yeah. really identify a conflict.
I think that came through. I think he was not conflicted about what he was studying.
Right.
There was no conflict between his religion and what he was studying.
No, in fact, he felt that what he was studying enhanced his religion.
Yes. But it was interesting. He's trying to convert you to his beliefs.
He actually doesn't really go around proselytizing to all the students. And everything. He pretty much keeps it to himself unless you ask him about it. In which case, he's more than willing to spend a long time telling you about it.
And as a filmmaker, I was certainly going to ask him about it.
Absolutely. we're talking about, and the film we're talking about is Blast. It's a film. Features Paul Devlin is made by Paul Devlin, featuring his brother Mark Devlin, and that's the other thing, and I think Sid pointed this out correctly, is that you have no idea the team of people who are behind a project like this, and as I say, you say in the movie, these are amateur engineers. They're mm-hmm. building stuff like out of Tinker Toy stuff, and they have no experience.
Mark might object to that characterization.
Did you call me an amateur?
Well, I saw the film when the duct tape came out.
There is duct tape going on.
How do you get training to learn how to build that object?
Is
it designed? Somebody has a blueprint, and you make it, and you put it together?
It's 50-50. I mean, you start with a napkin, and you start drawing, and you start making rough calculations about what you need, and right. then you just start building it around it. And when you need professional help, you call them in. But for the most part, we do it all ourselves.
And it's learning on the job a lot.
You learn on the job. I mean, I learned all my engineering skills just on the job. I bought a copy of AutoCAD, which is a design layout program, and just taught myself and then started drawing.
But the interesting thing is you're teaching the graduate students.
Yeah, then the graduate students go off, and they're in high demand because they learn. The students who do this kind of work, they learn the engineering, they learn the physics, they learn analysis, they learn how to program, they learn electronics. And so when they go into a job market, they can now say, well, I know how to do everything. I may not be an expert at everything, but certainly I can learn.
And it's doing science on the cheap.
Cheap.
Right?
Cheaper.
Cheaper. Relative.
Relative.
Compared to a satellite,
maybe. Sid, do you agree that this was a strength of the movie, watching all those kids there?
Absolutely, and it is the way it's done. When you're a graduate student, you learn the skills you have to make the experiment work. And as Mark said, often those skills will apply across the board in all kinds of engineering and technical applications. I'd like to make one more comment about the film, if I may. If you look at the credits at the end, I was delighted to see that there's a credit for a science writer. That's not something you'll ever see in a mainstream fiction film, but there was someone who apparently help make the science understandable as possible to a general audience. I think that was a great feature of that documentary and of many documentaries.
Thanks. That was Emily Kagan. She did a great job. We had some really talented people working. Richard Martinez did amazing work with the music. But that was very important for us to make the science accessible.
Right. Of course, Mark understands the science, but you need someone who has real experience in making sure it's at the right level for the audience.
Paul and I struggle with that quite a bit because I just screwed it up. He would ask me, and I would give him a very long technical description, and that's just not going to work for a movie like this.
Did you have to do takes over and over again?
Yes. not in the field. I mean, it's a documentary, so I mean, it's not like you can say, okay, launch that balloon again. You know? But when it came to descriptions of the science, we insisted that Mark do it in a way that would be understandable for a general audience. And I think as a result of that, he's getting better and better. Would you say, Mark?
Oh, I know. And I use those techniques in teaching my astronomy students now.
And the graphics are excellent also.
Yeah. A lot of those came directly from NASA, and we at first we thought we weren't going to be able to do a lot of that because the budgets were too high when we started sourcing it out, and so we just stole stuff off of YouTube and put it in the cut as a placeholder, and then we said, well, some of this stuff is perfect. Where is this coming from? And we went back and looked, and it came from NASA, and it turned out that NASA's graphics are public domain and free off the website.
That helps a lot.
So our budget for graphics went from hundreds of thousands down to zero. We had very high-end stuff for that.
I'll believe it. We're talking about science and movies this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm here talking with Paul Develin and his brother Mark, talking about the movie Blast. And at the end of the movie, you sort of hint at a next step. There's another astronomy project going on. Are you going to be documenting that at all?
Well, we'll see. You know, I mean, see what kind of funding we get for the next project. You know, it's all about funding. But I mean, Mark's got several going at once. I mean, that's part of the way he maintains his infrastructure, I believe. So we wanted to say that it's not just one thing. It's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. And you, where do you go from here with this research?
With this research, we just published 8 papers with 8 more coming, science papers, on the results from the flight, which is just amazing to me. It's actually more papers in the last year than I've published in the last 10 years.
And so one of them was in Nature and got quite a bit of attention, BBC News, front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
So right. And you said the real work begins now because there's so much data.
Yeah, well, that was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So we're now wrapping that up now. I mean, I'd like to divest myself of this work and move on to something else. And so I have several different things in the fire right now. The one that's in Chile, which is a 6-meter
ground
telescope.
Based. Yeah, ground based.
Nice on the ground occasionally. It's nice to be there. And that one's doing cosmic wave background work, and I have another balloon experiment.
I was going to say, would you do this?
Oh, yeah.
What have you learned that you would apply to the next balloon?
Oh, boy. I would one would spoil the movie, which is
we can't spoil too many surprises in the
but
movie.
But there are a couple steps that you would take that would be really easy to make sure you get your data back. And the other is really how to work with the students and the postdocs as the principal investigator of an experiment. It's a modest-sized experiment with only 20 or so people involved. But managing all that and getting it done and not killing yourself is a skill that has to be acquired. Mm-hmm. And now I've learned that, so it seems easier to me to go and start again.
Mm-hmm. And where can we see the movie now? That's at?
Well, let's see. We're starting to book in independent theaters across the country. So, at the moment, we just played in Columbia last night. We expect to have other university screenings coming up. So it's also check out the website, blastthemovie.com. And there'll be screenings.
Have you made any return on your investment on this yet?
Well, you know, that's depends how you define return and investment. The thing is, the movie's been doing spectacularly well in Europe. We got co-production with the BBC. It's played in Sweden and Denmark and Netherlands. Al Jazeera's bought it. Discovery Canada. We've had a little trouble in the United States. Frankly, there's been some resistance. So we're still trying to place the movie on television here. And I think that there's some resistance in the mainstream to pure science. And then we have, like we said, we had a little bit of resistance in the science community to the religion. So we're walking a very narrow path.
This is going to get virally spread.
Right,
you
exactly.
Know? And there is a great thirst for science films out there.
Yeah, well, we hope. I mean, my intention originally was not to necessarily make a pure science film, but really about the scientists.
Yeah, it is.
Because that had not been seen before, and I had the access. So I was really interested in that element. And I think that's going to emerge as it gets seen more and more, that people really have a thirst for seeing what scientists are really doing.
Well, I want to thank thank you both for taking time to be with us today. And good luck to you. The film Blast is terrific. I recommend you go out and see it and try to, you know, get others to see it. Paul Develin and his brother Mark Develin. Mark is the astrophysicist professor at Pennsylvania University, and he's the star, one of the stars of Blast. And Paul Develin is the director of the film. Thank you both for taking time.
Thanks. Thank you.
To be with us today. We're going to take a short break and continue our theme of science in the movies. And we're going to talk about a science fiction film called Sleep Dealer. And we're going to be talking with Alex Rivera, who's the writer and director of Sleep Dealer. A really interesting look into the future that's really quite plausible when you think about where the internet is heading. And this is sort of a movie about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about science and films and science-oriented summary films you might want to find at your local theaters. We've been talking, the last film we talked about was a documentary. The next one we're going to be talking about is a science fiction film that's set in the near future in Mexico. It's called Sleep Dealer, and it really takes us to a world where instead of showing up at a construction site, let's say you're a worker, you don't go to a construction site, you commute to something called a sleep dealer factory, and you work on a construction site remotely. You never go there, via sort of a futuristic internet world where you can work anywhere in the world and you're hooked up remotely. Here to tell us more about it is the guy who's is the writer and a director of Sleep Dealer, Alex Rivera, and he joins us here in our studios. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you again. This idea that you can work remotely as a sleep dealer, how did that idea come about?
Well, about 10 years ago, I was reading an article in Wired magazine that talked about telecommuting and this idea that in the future, everybody could work from home. There'd be no traffic jams. There'd be no people on subways because we'd all be working from home. Well, half of my family is immigrants, people who came from Latin America to work here in the United States in construction, in landscaping. And I had this moment where my brain started to wander about a future in which they could telecommute. And this image came to me of a world where maybe the border is sealed, and instead of crossing the border physically, workers in this near future would connect their bodies to a kind of network and control a machine that does their labor in America so that their energy, their labor arrives here to this country, but their bodies stay out. And when I came up with this idea about a decade ago, it was a metaphor, it was a joke, it was, you know, it was just a way of kind of criticizing, in a sense, the anti-immigrant politics in this country, that where there's 14 million undocumented people here that are working, that rent apartments, that buy goods, but that there's always this kind of noise to throw them out.
Right.
And so this sense of being here but not here, that political critique created this metaphor and this image, that this fantasy that my project started with.
How would you know that this could come true?
Well, yeah, I didn't.
In the internet, right?
Yeah.
Pre-internet days.
Yeah, this was when I came up with the idea where we're all on dial-up, you know, and people were fantasizing about telecommuting and virtual reality. And then around 2000, 2001, we started to see in the news articles about outsourcing, right? And this idea that companies were hiring people in India over the net. And so they started to talk about this wave of workers who were on the other side of the planet but working live in America.
Right.
And then I started to sort of scratch my head and say, wait a second, maybe this isn't a joke. Maybe this is where globalization is going.
Yeah. Also with this is Sidney Perkowitz, who is author of Hollywood Science. He's also professor of physics at Emory. Sidney, it's amazing how reality catches up with you.
And in fact, it's even more real than Alex was indicating, because there's been a lot of work done in the last 5 or 10 years about direct neural connections that let people operate devices outside their bodies. So this is reality. I mean, I thought Sleep Dealer was science fiction in the finest tradition. It took an existing trend and extended in an extremely believable way. So it really works at that level.
It really is believable. I myself, when I saw it, I said this doesn't take a whole big quantum leap in imagination.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we could be there in 15 or 20 years or less.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, that's not necessarily okay.
Exactly, that's a
right.
whole other side of it, right?
Yeah,
there's a political side to it too.
Yeah. Go ahead, Alex. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when we see this whole question of outsourcing and the idea that this world connected, which for us in our daily lives, it enables Facebook, this thing called Twittering, which I still don't understand, and the sense of being connected around the globe socially. Well, for corporations, they're able to use that connectivity to hunt for cheaper and cheaper workers in more distant corners of the planet. And right now, 30 years ago, we became accustomed to factories moving around the planet and using systems of transportation to send goods to American markets. About 10 years ago, we became accustomed to this outsourcing, offshoring thing in call centers in India. That process isn't over. So what's next? And in Sleep Dealer, it puts forth this vision of what's next. What if you got in a taxi in New York and it was being driven by somebody in Pakistan, somebody in halfway around the world? And what kind of a city would that create? What kind of an America would that be if globalization was taken to this slightly, taken to its logical conclusion, this idea of a totally connected, totally free market?
And you also had the Sleep Dealers were working for next to nothing also, right? I mean, they weren't getting paid very well either, even though they're working on these, for example, a construction site where if you were at the site, you might be making some real money.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not at the site, you're working at a robot that's building something.
Exactly right. And in the film, the vision is of the story follows a young man, a young boy from southern Mexico who leaves his village and ends up in the city. But instead of coming to America, he ends up in the city, sort of in Mexico, trapped on the other side of a border wall. And he goes into this factory where he finds himself. He discovers that he's working on the top of a skyscraper under construction. And next to him are these other machines being controlled by other people. One might be in China. One might be in Malaysia. One might be in Brazil. And so he's in this workforce where he's never able to even know who his coworkers are. And so it's this vision of that's slightly comedic, but a portrait of a totally alienated a person. So.
And you might also be fighting wars that way, right? You show the military side of it.
Yeah. Sleep Dealer looks at three characters. And to me, that was one of the fun parts of developing the story, was looking at the future from all of these angles through these different characters. And so we've got that near future worker that we've talked about. One of the other characters is a near future soldier who is fighting wars from America, but over the net. He's controlling a thing called a drone,
what a concept.
Exactly.
10 years ago, who would ever have those things, right?
Exactly. I mean, when I was reading about these drones and saying 10 years ago they were out there, but it was a subplot to the American military, right? And now it's center stage. This past month, there's been a lot of noise about drones. It's hard to talk about in a conversation about science fiction because it's a painful reality from today, but drones killing innocent people in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so that's in my science fiction. That's one of the characters, a drone pilot who is fighting this kind of remote war. And he's kind of a mirror image to the remote worker.
It's hard to sell this as a science fiction movie anymore, right, Sid? I mean,
it's almost not right. It's a science movie, just about. Yeah,
I think
because it's really happening. But the political commentary is a really important part of it, and you make the point in different ways. That there's one brief snatch of conversation. One of the workers isn't even sure what city he's in. There's how isolated they are in the factory. All of that comes through loud and clear. The factory foreman says the U.S. wants our work but doesn't want our workers. So that part of it is quite a strong thread in the story.
Mm-hmm. Hey, do you think you would have trouble pitching it today? Pitching this movie today?
Well, it would have to be described as a period piece. If we started the movie today, by the time it came out, it might be a period piece and not a science fiction. But I'm definitely hoping to make a sequel. So.
Yeah. Where's it playing now? Where can we see it?
Well, right now, I believe it's in Seattle. I believe it's in San Diego. It's kind of been hard to keep track. It's been moving around the country kind of quickly. The most reliable thing for people to do is look to the website, sleepdealer.com, and it's on Netflix. The DVD will come out, so look for it on DVD.
One of the most fascinating futuristic aspects of your film is what you thought blogging would look like in the future, but it was a whole much more personal. Tell us what your blogger does in the movie.
Well, that's, of course, the third main character in the film is a woman named Luce. And in this future, which is a future of technology connecting distant points on the globe, but borders dividing countries and dividing North and South, her role is as a writer, a blogger of the future. And instead of using a keyboard and a mouse to input her words, like bloggers do today, she connects her body directly to the network and she uploads her memories and she sells them the way a journalist would sell a story, a stringer would write a story and sell it. That's what she does, but she does it straight out of her nervous system and she shares her memories. And so the story follows her when she meets the main character. She uploads a memory of meeting him and somebody out there buys it and pays in advance for more memories. And so she's got this motivation to learn more about the main character, kind of pursue him, and that ends up creating all kinds of conflicts around her. But the technology, the idea of recording memories, is something that I think a lot of science fiction films have experimented with and is also about to happen. I mean, I've been reading a lot about technology in Japan, this machine called the Dream Machine that they've got actually up and running where you put your head in it and they show you images in front of your eyes and then they can scan, I think it's the visual cortex of your brain, and on a TV monitor show a rough image of what you're seeing with your eyes. And so this idea that in the future the camera would disappear and it would really be our eyes that pick up the images and that would be able to share them the way we share photographs today, well, I believe that's where this process of innovation in image capturing and image sharing, that's where it's going.
Well, you're also ahead of your time in figuring out how to make money on the internet. It's a fictional part. But that's an interesting. Sidya, I know you want to say something. Go ahead.
There was one really scary part, speaking as a writer, about how Lewis blogged on her computer, because at a couple of points when she faltered a little bit, the computer told her how to do her thinking and her writing. It said simplify things. So she, to some extent, was being directed by the software. And again, speaking as a writer, I thought that was the scariest part of the whole scenario.
Well, so yeah, the idea being that, you know, if we're connected, if this character is connected to the network and uploading her memories, maybe there'd be something like a lie detector in there, and a client would pay for a story that was verified as being truthful. And what it really did was create a character out of her computer, so her computer can interrupt her and say, "Come on, tell me the truth. You know, you're straying. That's not the whole story." And so the computer become a character.
There's another great theme in there is that how the people can connect to each other's nodes, right, to get to know each other better.
Mm-hmm.
The whole body gets in there,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's one scene in which my main characters make love, and I watched a lot of science fictions, and you've seen time and again people sticking cables in their body. We saw it in The Matrix. We've seen it in Johnny Mnemonic. We see it in many science fiction films. People connect. Existence by Cronenberg. I'd never seen a love scene, though, where the characters connect. And so this was maybe not necessarily a scientific impulse, but a one to have fun with the genre, to have my characters making love and plugging in multiple ways.
We're talking about science and film this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Alex Rivera, author, writer, and director of Sleep Dealer. I say this is a great film, and it is really more science than science fiction. And getting back to the characters connecting and making love by computer, if you talk to as I have on our program, to the next generation of video game makers, this is what's going to be happening. Mm-hmm. You know, in the next generation of video games, you know, it's all about this sort of stuff going on there.
Yeah.
And people talk to each other in video games now, so I imagine that's where we're headed.
That's exactly the process of Sleep Dealers, imagining this hyper-connectivity, and we can see it marching forward so quickly. I think a lot of people who are interested in science know Moore's Law, the idea that computers double in speed every, I think, year more or less. Well, the sense of connectivity, transmission, that we can hear each other, see each other over great distances in more profound ways, more and more as every day goes by. Well, Sleep Dealer takes that as a given and imagines a hyper-connected world, but then looks at that from a point of view we've never seen before, across borders, looking at it from a point of view of a worker in Latin America, a soldier in North America, and this blogger, writer character who kind of ties them all together. And But, you know, so the process was really fun and challenging to try to think about this connected world from many different points of view.
Sid, you have any reaction to that?
That is the strength of the film, as I keep saying in different ways. It brings out the human aspect of what this connectivity means from the viewpoint of globalization and also from the viewpoint of person-to-person contact. Really couldn't be a stronger human story in all the ways that matter, in my opinion.
And for me, I mean, one of the things, in terms of looking at science fiction, too, I'd never seen a film in all my years of watching science fiction that looked at the future from the point of view of the South. We've seen Los Angeles, we've seen Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, London. We've never seen Jakarta, or we've never seen Sao Paulo, or we've never seen Mexico City, even though it's so patently obvious that the whole planet is going to the future. We're all going there together. But in science fiction cinema, I'd never seen the future from the point of view of the South, and that also became a really exciting part of my process, was to try to intervene in the genre and try to do something really new with it.
Are you hooked on science fiction now? You going to make another film?
Right.
You said a sequel's coming.
Yeah, I mean, I love the genre because it lets me do what I'm really passionate about. I studied political theory in college, you know. I didn't study film. And science fiction, whether we see it or feel it or not, is always about development, economics, politics.
Right.
That's always underneath the surface. Whenever you start to paint a picture of the future, you're painting a vision of development and how this journey, economic and political journey that we're all on together, unfolds. And so I love science fiction because it lets us take a glimpse into the world that we're building, you know. And but that being said, I'm also really tired and I want to do a film that's easier to make for my next project. So I'm trying to do either a documentary or a true story. Because
why was this so hard to make, Sleep Dog?
It was hard to make, because when you start to talk about the future, every question is open. So, for example, on set, the wardrobe department would bring me these crazy like S&M outfits. Do people wear this in the bar in the future? No. People wearing blue jeans in the future.
Right.
This is not about, you know, people walking around in leather straps and, you know, so.
It's not Star Trek. Not Star Wars either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But everything from what does a car look like to how do people dress to everything gets tossed up in the air, and everything becomes a question you have to answer when you're working in the future. And so creatively, it's a heavy exercise on top of all the things a filmmaker needs to do, which is track characters, create conflict between them, you know, create an effective scene. And so there's so much work involved, creative work, as well as the producing work of trying to get somebody on board to pay for this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you in your next film.
Oh, thank you so much.
Can't wait to see what it looks like. Alex Rivera, who is a writer and director of Sleep Dealer, we'll see it out there. See it when you can. And it's a great film. Also, thank you, Sid, for taking time to be with us today. Sid Berkowitz, you're welcome, is the author of Hollywood Science, a great book if you want to pick it up, and a professor of physics at Emory University. Thank you both for taking time to be with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have a Science Friday's Pick of the Week. Our videos are up there. Also, we're tweeting all week, at SciFry is our Twitter address. And you can send letters and all kinds of stuff and podcasts and things like that at sciencefriday.com. We'll look forward to seeing you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.